Back together, you and I, for a Friday, April 22nd, 2022 edition of Connecticut Today right here on WICC. I talked a bit about the current war of words between Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis and the Disney Corporation. I think Governor DeSantis has to be a little careful here if it ends up costing folks money. Federalist Senior Editor Chris Bedford joined us to talk about what the possible purchase of Twitter by billionaire Elon Musk would mean for social media. Yankee Institute for Public Policy, Director of Policy and Research Ken Girardin came back to the program here to offer his thoughts on the new Connecticut State employee contract. This Florida Disney thing, and we've been talking about this over the past couple of shows, because it is top of mind in the news. It's a fight here. Florida passing what is called the Don't Say Gay Bill, which is, you know, a tag that was given to it by its opponents and those in the media. Basically, what the bill says is no gender-based education or talk until kids are in the fourth grade. So preschool, kindergarten, first, second, and third grade, no talk about how little boys may want to feel about little girls, or they feel like little girls, or girls feel like boys. And just because you have certain appendages or don't, that doesn't mean you're that gender, you know, whatever. So Ron DeSantis, for whatever reason, and I think he's baiting the left here, he decides to push through this bill. Now, of course, Disney pops a cork. They tried not to say something at the beginning. Some of their workers were getting very upset about that. So Disney says, well, screw you, essentially. Well, they didn't exactly say that. They sort of did. But they said, look, Governor, we don't like it. We're an inclusive company, so 50% of our characters by X year are going to be LGBTQI, whatever it is, and people of color and minorities. Okay, so now Ron DeSantis comes back, and he's going to sign it. He may have signed it today, stripping a special consideration that Disney has had in Florida for decades, since they opened in Florida, regarding their self-governance and there's tax implications there, whatever. So here's the bottom line. I'm thinking about that, and everybody is seeing Ron DeSantis as, you know, the next coming of Trump. He's a nicer Trump, right? He's tough on all the key areas, but he's a more palatable Trump. I got to tell you, if I'm Governor DeSantis here, you got to be careful. And part of the reason that I'm saying this now, and this has popped into my head, is you're seeing here now that if he strips the special designation they have about self-governance from Disney in Florida, and they come back and say, well, guess what? This is going to cost us money, and we're not going to give you the same cash considerations we used to. I'm not sure how it works, but I got to tell you something. When you start screwing with people's wallets, that's not good. It's just not. I don't care if you're trying to get yourself reelected governor, or if you lose, get yourself elected president, or if you win, get yourself elected president. Because it's interesting, because you have a lot of even Republicans now across the country, and I'm seeing these stories pop up. But you have a lot of Republicans saying, hey, Governor, we love you, but pump the brakes a little bit on this Disney stuff. And I understand what they're saying, because you have to understand something. The way the common voter looks at this, what happens is folks who do shows like this that I'm fortunate to do for you every Monday through Friday from 2 to 6, folks who are on cable news, folks who are in politics, we're all into the minutiae of this. Oh, let me dig. Oh, peel back that layer, whatever. And, you know, is somebody, is Disney grooming kids, and we're stepping in to stop that and save little kids. Here's the bottom line. A lot of people don't get into that as much as a lot of other people do. They simply see Disney as Disney. They see Disney still in the year 2022. They see Disney World, Disneyland, the other theme parks, Disney Plus, the Disney Channel. They see that as innocent escapism. they may say, okay, you know, I'm not into getting all the LGBTQ stuff shoved at me, and there's got to be a quota of minority characters. You know, a lot of people say that, but you know what? My kids like it. They like the movies. We went there and had a good time. I can sit my grandson or granddaughter down in front of a Disney movie, and they laugh and they giggle and they like it. That's the kind of thing here that I've thought about the last day or so. And especially when it comes to money, be very careful, because whether a lot of conservatives like it or not, and whether a lot of conservatives think they're doing a gallant thing, you can't screw with Americana. And whether people like it or not, Disney is part of America. Now, I know they could say, well, that's why the left is using Disney to impose their will on American kids. Well, you know what that is? You know, like James Carville always says on the Democratic side, that's faculty room bull. You know what it is? You know what I mean? Bull, you know what? And Carville always says the worst thing the political parties can do is engage in faculty room stuff. Remember how people think. Remember how the average voter thinks. So how is it going to look if some of the Republicans and Ron DeSantis overplay their hands against Disney? Now, they took the bait from you on this don't say gay bill, this quote-unquote don't say gay bill, but you got to know when to back off. You know, the old song, got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them. And I just wonder now, as you're trying to, you're kind of seeing this little ripple across the country, even from some really right-wing websites I go to. They're not crazy, but they have a lot of conservative writers, and a lot of them are saying, hey, Governor, be careful you don't descend into the very thing that you're trying to criticize. See? So it's interesting. I don't know if Ron DeSantis is doing this of his own volition, if he has advisors, if this stuff is focus-grouped, if it's just stuff he's banking on. I don't know. But again, be careful. There are certain things people reflexively react negatively to when you beat on. I'm guessing Disney is one of them. The average parent, the average grandparent, the average aunt, uncle, they don't want to hear all the political stuff. All they know is their kids, their grandkids, their nieces and nephews had a great time when I took them to Disney, or I always get them a Disney toy, or I got them those Disney DVDs. So, you know, I hang on Democrats all the time because they do this. They overplay their hand and it bites them in the rear end. And you know what? Republicans do it too. So take a breath on the Disney stuff. For now, let it just sit there, relax. Right now, though, I wanted to have this gentleman back on. He's from Wright Forge. He's been on the show a couple times previously because I want to try and figure out, pick his brain, if he can tell me why everybody's going crazy. You got people clutching pearls, banging their heads on the wall, that Elon Musk may buy Twitter. Will it be the end of the world? Chris Bedford, senior editor at The Federalist, chief communications officer for Wright Forge, and vice chairman of Young Americans for Freedom. Chris, Paul here again in Connecticut. Good to have you on. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to be back.
Thanks, Chris, for taking the time. I know you're busy. So, Chris, explain this to me. If Elon Musk buys Twitter, is that the end of the world? I mean, the stuff I'm reading here, it's like the world will implode if Elon Musk buys Twitter. What's the deal here? What's going on?
The deal here is they've exposed themselves for exactly what they are. The problem with Elon Musk is not that this is a private company or a private billionaire controlling speech. That they're totally fine with that. That's been their policy now for years. The problem is it's someone who's not completely on their team. What's wild about this is that Elon Musk is not actually even kind of a conservative. He's more of just a contrarian. He's someone who doesn't follow with the ruling class on every single one of the opinions, every single one of the things that they demand. And right now, the ruling class is largely demanding censorship. You get that from our tech leaders. You get that from our politicians. You get that from CNN. You get that from Barack Obama. Elon Musk is saying, hold on a second, why should your user agreement in Silicon Valley have more sway over how Americans conduct their public square business than the Bill of Rights does? So him just coming out there and saying, well, I'm interested in buying this. I'm interested in making a difference instead of just complaining. It's basically forced all these people to come out and say exactly what they think, which is they're not in favor of free speech, and they don't want just anyone to control this stuff. They're not actually libertarian in their ideas or free market. They want their billionaires to control it.
So, what do you say then, Chris Bedford, to the people who say, well, we're all for free speech, wink, wink, but as Elon Musk is going to let a lot of these right-wing wackos back on Twitter, the ones that we just cleansed from our system? What do you say to those people who say, listen, free speech is one thing, but we can't let certain people and certain ideas back on Twitter?
Well, those people aren't for free speech at all. I mean, a lot of folks on the left will always say that they're interested in your opinion. You've got a right to it, but they're completely surprised to find out that anyone has a different opinion than their own. And when they do, they want that. They want those opinions censored. Now, this started out with people saying, well, this is about a public health issue. COVID has been used for so much gains and control over what people's lives and what people say. People said, oh, it's just a public health issue. We don't want folks spreading disinformation. And what did that disinformation start as? First, there were people saying you needed to wear masks. Then it was people saying, well, the CDC said you don't need to wear masks. Then it was vaccination stuff. It was school stuff. Any kind of criticism of their rules was called an attack on public health. But since then, we've gone well beyond that. We've seen the president of the United States taken off. We've seen social media platforms like Parler destroyed that had not even anything to do with anything under completely spurious ideas. We've seen a newspaper, the New York Post, founded by a founding father of the United States, have their story censored, possibly in a way that could have even shifted election results. We've seen this expand so dramatically. It's to the point where you have elected senators and congressmen and television hosts in The View saying that people like Tucker Carlson should be investigated and possibly imprisoned for taking a side against a different side from theirs on a foreign war. So what began as, well, we need to protect the public health, has quickly become, we can only allow speech that aligns with our worldview.
I see, Chris Bedford, that some of the stockholders here on Twitter, they're trying to put in these kind of securities, poison pills here to try and slow down or stop Elon Musk. What do you think here? Is he going to be successful in this, or is just putting a scare in some of these folks enough? What do you think on that?
I don't think any of this is going to be enough in the end, but I do think that Twitter is going to do everything they can to try and stop this. They're going to open themselves up to a lot of lawsuits from different shareholders, some of whom have already announced this, who say that this is a problem. The state of Florida, where I'm in right now for a conference, that the governor said, well, we have pensions invested with Twitter, so they've got a stake, and they could bring lawsuits against Twitter for this. So it's going to get very messy, but if you're a free speech advocate, it's good to watch in general, because either he wins and Twitter changes, or he doesn't win, and all these people, like it has been happening so far, get exposed for what they really think and the contempt that they hold for our Bill of Rights. But either way this goes, one billionaire named Elon is not going to save this. We need to turn around our society more broadly. It's going to take a lot of folks. Ron DeSantis, Elon Musk, these people are not enough. It takes us all being more informed consumers. It takes us building our own internet servers and getting. It takes us even starting our own banking institutions if you want to be able to be able to continue to do business. This is a broader fight, and it's going to take a lot of Americans to win it.
Hey, Chris, final question. Why has it been so difficult for other modes to get up and underway here? Why has it been so difficult, for example, for somebody or some corporation or some investors, even though we've had attempts at this, to go up against, say, something like Twitter and to say to Twitter, okay, if you want to operate the way you want, fine, we want to do ours. Why is that so tough?
There's a couple things that have gone into it, but mainly it's you have to get the really right people and really talented people, and you can't play favorites. That's been something that some companies have gone with. Also, you can't just launch an alternative that's simply conservative. You need to launch one that's free speech or one that welcomes all kinds of people. You need someone who's got a lot of draw, like President Trump has had with Truth Social, someone who, once he gets involved with that, will bring a lot more people in. And not only that, but when you launch an alternative tech platform nowadays, that's an automatically political space. It means that any mistake that you ever make is going to be amplified 1,000 times by the New York Times and their friends. It means that you're going to come under immediate attack from hackers like the groups Anonymous that will attack you. there's no room for error. And some of these attempts have been very good, and I have some hope for them. Other ones, they've maybe done a little too much politics and not enough tech, and that's been a mistake. But I see a lot of really talented people waking up all over the world, like Elon Musk, who's saying, hold on, I'm going to bring my considerable talents and my capital to this problem because free speech is an important fight to have.
Chris Bedford. Chris, thanks. He's a senior editor at The Federalist, chief communications officer for Rice Borge, and vice chair of Young Americans for Freedom. Check it out online, rightforge.com. Chris, thanks. We'll be in touch. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Christopher Bedford there. We've had him on before. And you can check out the internet hosting company that he speaks for, rightforge.com, and maybe that's where you want to set up your business there. They are trying to become a company that is devoid of politics. They try and not threaten anybody to not carry web traffic for, you know, a certain type of app or a certain type of service because of politics. You know, I don't know, and I'm so thankful that Chris came on, and I understand what he's saying. I wonder, though, if just because of human nature, just because of, you know, the human beasts that we are, if there will ever be a truly free and open internet kind of messaging app, because there are always people who are going to say, hey, you can't just... You know, and I hate to use this phrase, but it's pretty much the only one that makes sense sometimes. You pretty much cannot yell fire in a crowded theater when there is none. And again, growing up, you and I, you folks out there, you're around what I am age-wise, maybe a little older, a little younger. If we acted crazy, if we were on the street corner screaming something or giving out leaflets in school, that's where it ended, usually. If we were screaming and yelling, a few people might look at us and walk away. If we were handing out crazy things in school or in our college dorms, people would approach us and say, what are you doing? The problem with all this, no matter how you fall on the spectrum of internet good, internet bad, is, you know, besides the good stuff, right? The movies, the streaming videos, the sports and everything, one click of a mouse or one tap on a phone or on a screen, that does have the potential to send craziness all around the world. And sometimes that ain't good. Sometimes. I would say most of the times, but hey, that's just me. We welcome back Ken Girardin. He's the Director of Policy and Research at the Yankee Institute. They continue to do analyses on the proposed state employee contract, and Ken is watching what's going on in the General Assembly. Hey, Ken, it's Paul here. Good afternoon again, sir. How are you?
Hey, Paul. I wouldn't call it a good afternoon, not for Connecticut taxpayers.
Well, let me get into that. Yeah. So, Ken, does it look like the entire state employee package is pretty much going to be passed and voted in by both chambers? I know it already passed the House, Senate stuff due today. Pretty much as it was submitted to the governor?
It passed the Senate about an hour ago.
Okay.
And just to give your listeners some background on why I would sound so frustrated by that, This was a 1,700-page document. Some parts of it were handwritten, grainy document that the governor sent over to the General Assembly and said, here you go. When the independent analysts looked at it, they said the price tag was going to be $1.9 billion over 4 years. That works out to $41,000 per state worker between now and when the deal expires in 2025. And that got voted on without the governor even having to present them with the actual final documents. This was, like I said, just something that you would get an F if you turned this in for a college finance assignment. Let's put it that way.
So you're saying, Ken, that there weren't – I just want to make sure we understand what you're saying here. The final document, and I know people say, well, as long as it's on paper, it's a legal contract, whatever. But you're saying that the final – or the document that lawmakers were supposed to, you know – go through, carefully look at, was 1,700 pages, and some of it, you say, was not real clear, was grainy, it was handwritten, really?
Parts of it were handwritten. Parts of it were handwritten. I think parts of it were pages that weren't supposed to be included, that they were things that were offered at the negotiating table but not finalized. It just start to finish, it was a really unprofessional process where you first had negotiations happening behind closed doors, and then you had the governor say, well, we got a deal on March 8th, and then he made the General Assembly wait 3 weeks before he gave them any details. And then April Fool's Day, Friday afternoon, he sprung these details in this format on them with all sorts of incomplete cost estimates, grainy handwritten pages, missing pages, just really not something that invites trust that the public interest is being served. And as we've crunched the numbers, we've seen that really this document does not serve the public interest. You've told your listeners plenty of the details already. This won't be new to you, but there's some really shocking stuff in there.
Ken, hang on. We'll get right back to you on this. Ken Girard, an analyst for the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in the state. More on the just passed, within the past few hours, the new contract for public workers, state workers in the state. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And we have a few more minutes here with Ken Girard, policy analyst, lead analyst for the Yankee Institute. Check him out, yankeeinstitute.org. Ken, something you mentioned in our first part of our chat today that really galls me as to how we do things in this state. We saw it with the state employee contract. We're seeing it now with the budget and the crunch timelines and everything. And listen, good people can disagree, left versus right, Democrat versus Republican, you know, private sector versus public sector. But Ken, it just galls me the haphazard way sometimes that we do things in this state, certain people not being at the table, stuff being tossed out on these weird timelines, things you mention without even clear documents. And this is not the first time you and I have heard this stuff. This seems to go on, Ken, you know, stuff done behind closed doors. It just seems, Ken, that there is an enduring disrespect for the process in this state that really bothers me.
It's funny you say that, because on the one hand, Connecticut is great in that we have a really healthy legislative committee process where all sides get heard. It's really collaborative. People come together to make legislation truly better and work better, even where they have disagreements. We have an independent office that helps the legislature figure out the price tag on stuff that the governor is throwing their way. We have all sorts of safeguards to get a good sense of what's on our horizon fiscally. So in that regard, Connecticut is much better. I mean, we have, you know, New York is a basket case by comparison, if anybody looks closely at how Albany does stuff. I mean, they really some days exist just to make Hartford look better.
I mean, which is pretty good. Yeah,
but,
right.
But going back to what you described as haphazard, with respect to the way that state government does stuff to benefit the public sector unions, there is nothing haphazard about it. It is deliberate. It is calculated. It is done to minimize the extent to which the public can wise up to what is going on. I could tie up your listeners all day telling horror stories about how there are state workers who are released from their jobs full time on government pay just to go and do political union stuff. There are all sorts of powers and privileges that these folks have been given, and they get it because our elected officials want to get the benefit from these folks at election time. And this will not change until Connecticut residents begin asking politicians the questions, okay, what did you have to promise to get that union endorsement? What did you give up on the public interest end of things to get the public sector unions to endorse your campaign? Until Connecticut taxpayers start demanding answers on that, nothing is going to change. Now, the fortunate thing is we've seen from other states, when other states wise up to this stuff and they start pressuring the political class to put the public interest on at least equal footing as the public employee union interests, mm-hmm. better things happen. You get better outcomes. But this has not been a haphazard approach. This was deliberate. They wanted as little public analysis and public review as possible. That's why it was such a big deal that Yankee Institute was coming out with cost estimates that the governor's office wouldn't provide.
Ken, part of the union side of this and part of the Democratic side was, well, the union had givebacks three different times, I think, in the past 5 or 6 years. And yes, they did. That was documented, which I find interesting as a selling point because, you know, after all this government money is gone and this, you know, expansive budget surplus that we finally have is gone, you know, the outlying years, 2, 3, 4 years down the road, Ken, is anybody going to be surprised if we get back in a sea of red ink and then they're going to just go back to the unions again and say, hey, our bad, we need givebacks from you people again. Aren't we kind of caught in this vicious cycle here?
I mean, you're highlighting one of the fundamental problems with public sector collective bargaining. But let me ask, if we're going to go back to ancient history, let's go back to 2000. Let's take listeners mm-hmm. back to black and white. I'm old enough to remember 2000.
Me too.
Y2K and all that fun
yeah.
stuff. If you go and look at state payroll since 2000, not the number of people, not the average pay, the total pay we were putting out the door in paychecks. And you take that to 2020. If that number had just tracked inflation from 2000 to 2020, the state of Connecticut would have paid $10 billion less. That is just in wages and salaries. That's without getting into the Cadillac benefits that the unions had, that the unions have preserved, that are almost unprecedented in the private sector. If you go mm-hmm. even with the labor market being so tight, if you go into almost any job interview and say, "Oh, and I want a guaranteed payment from you every year after I retire, and I want retiree health care until I qualify for Medicare," you're going to get laughed out of the office. But that's the kind of really outsized benefit package that has been preserved. So on the one hand, yes, you hear the unions say, "Oh, we went years without automatic raises. We sacrificed." Like, well, you've previously defended your Cadillac benefit package by saying you traded. So it's either one or the other. Either you've had sacrifice, in which case, how about we give you private sector level benefits, or you didn't sacrifice. You kept the health coverage that would cost, you know, $31,000 if you had to buy it on the private market that we give you for $3,000 a year, or this guaranteed pension, which you can get in very, very, you know, a shrinking number of places.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have it both ways.
Understood. Ken, thank you. Ken Girardin, Senior Policy Analyst, Yankee Institute. Check him out online, yankeeinstitute.org. Ken, your analysis is always welcome. Keep watching the numbers, and we'll get back to you. Thanks.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
Appreciate it right there. Well, there you go, folks. Listen, you have to decide whether or not you think this is a good and fair deal for state unions, whether it's an okay deal, or whether you think it's too much of a burden on the state. I don't know. I'm not a state worker, never have been, probably never would be. I have friends of mine and relatives who are state workers. I talk to them about their workplace, and they tell me, just like the public workplace, there are great employees and there are complete slackers. So it is what it is. But over the 4 year span of this new contract, it's going to cost about $1.9 billion in raises and bonuses. 46,000 state workers are going to be getting, from you and me, because we are the taxpayers, an average $40,000 increase over the 4 years per worker. And what did Ken say there? The benefits package that you and I are paying for as taxpayers is worth about $31,000 per worker, for which they're only charged $3,000. So listen, you know, as Ken said, you would think people reflect their choice in this in the ballot box. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. So there you go. You can draw your own conclusions. We try and just give you the numbers.